I did something that I never thought I'd do the other day. I just skipped Figma. Like, I just didn't use Figma in my design process. I needed a few components, a couple pages on a website, and I started exploring directly in Framer. It's becoming second nature now. Like, it's just as easy to draw a rectangle in Framer as it is in Figma, only now you're one click away from seeing it live on a real website. It's easy, it's fun, and Framer is fundamentally changing the way that I design and build websites. If you want to experience it for yourself, head to dive.club/framer to learn more. Okay, now onto the episode.
You are almost like a little mini founder, and the bonus to you is you have the actual skill set to go validate that stuff on their behalf. That makes you indispensable. Every founder I know would adore that type of person. And so prior to product market fit, yeah, you should be the ideas guy. You should be coming up with prototypes on their behalf. You should be going to talk to customers and bringing it up to them. That's how you win, you know, influence. And that's how you actually work with an early stage company and make them feel like you're there with them, as opposed to downstream and waiting for instruction. No founder wants that.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Today, we're talking with Helen Tran, who was an early designer at Shopify, and now she's leading product design at AngelList. But in between those two roles, she also ran her own startup for 3 years. So the goal of this conversation is to figure out how that period of time impacted Helen's design practice so that we could all learn how to design with a founder's mindset. So to set the stage, I asked Helen to give us a little rundown of her journey as a designer.
I think I'm driven a lot by curiosity and love of learning, and obviously having to pay the bills. So I didn't come from a background in which that was easy to do. Let's just say that. And so, you know, as a fresh-faced 17-year-old, what am I going to do with my life? And we couldn't really afford university. And I knew that I could get in and out of a college diploma. In Canada, it's a diploma. It's the equivalent of an associate's degree for $10,000, something like that. That sounds ludicrous, but it's not because I'm from like the 1800s. It's because school is literally cheaper in Canada. So I went through that school and I wasn't academically inclined at that age. And I just wanted to go out and work. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be active. I wanted to do stuff. And so design was that for me. And so I am formally trained, but at the time I was already making websites and stuff on my own, and school wasn't exactly teaching that, and the iPhone came out a little bit later in my school tenure. And stupidly, this is going to sound so ridiculous, but I didn't even think that you could make software. I didn't know that was a profession. I didn't know that's what people did. And that sounds silly, like, when I think about that now, like, why didn't you think that someone made that? Of course someone made that. But I didn't know. Like, you don't know what you don't know. So I was a traditional graphic designer for about 4 or 5 years until I wanted to more seriously get into software. And throughout this time, I was trying really, really hard, but I wasn't able to get a job. So I can really empathize with people hitting this market right now. And it was exceedingly hard for me to even get an interview. I think it took me like 8 months. And during that time, I did other things. I was a photographer. I opened up a photography studio. I started shooting for all of the fashion agencies in Toronto. And so I have a pretty deep background in art direction and creative direction. And I know a lot about beauty and makeup and fashion that probably isn't applicable to my day-to-day anymore. Eventually found my first design job. So I bounced around a couple of things, did a whole whack of work. I was also developing at that time. So I think one thing I'd say, I'm bouncing around a lot because my career was just kind of like, it's like a pinball machine. I was doing a lot because I had a lot of energy. I was really young and I had unlimited time. And what are you going to do with your unlimited time? My answer to that was just work all the time. I found my way into a user experience agency. And then eventually that agency was acquired by Shopify. And I was 5 years into my career at that point. I think people usually say that's a senior designer, but when I look back, I'm like, yeah, you're still a junior. And so I was acquired into Shopify. And yeah, the rest of the Shopify story happened, which is I was there at 278 and I remained there until 4,000 employees. Me and a couple of my other colleagues grew a team from me being the first product designer in Toronto to a team of 30. And, you know, I did a whole bunch of work. I made a whole bunch of friends who are still my best friends to this day. And it is a very formative experience for me. After leaving Shopify, I started my own startup. And I was just kind of diving in. I really had thought that I would take some time off of Shop, which is a big joke to my friends. And they were like, no way, you're not going to survive 4 months without a job. And yeah, just right on time, 3 months in, I was like, I'm starting a company. So I ran Jupiter for about just under 3 years. And that was an amazing experience. I learned a lot.
I think it's really interesting that you have this 3-year period as a founder. You get a very different perspective on things. And now you're 6 months in to leading design at AngelList. My question is, what are some of the ways that that experience as a founder has shaped the way that you're approaching your practice as a designer now?
Yeah, I think in all honesty, in my 20s, I didn't know what I didn't know. And you go in with good intentions to kind of like push your craft, push yourself, and make people know how important you are. And I think earlier on in your career, you try to do it in a very kind of clumsy sort of way. Like a bull in a china shop, or at least I was a lot like a bull in a china shop. And so my good intentions were there, but I don't know if I was always as efficient as I am now. I don't know if I was always as convincing as I am now. And over the years, especially as a founder, I started to really understand the types of decisions people are making day to day and why it didn't always go my way when I was younger. So when I contrast, for example, my experience with Shopify and my experience with AngelList now, sometimes I have these days where I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember what that was like in my 20s. I had this exact experience, but like 8 years ago. And then after having gone through the founder thing, I'm like, oh yes, I understand now why this isn't high priority for the company, or why we should probably take a step back and rethink this. Whereas in my 20s, I was always just trying to be like a pure designer. I was always just trying to push design forward. And I think that is needed. I think one person on your team needs to be that person for sure. But now I think a little bit more responsible and careful with the entire team to just make sure that we're efficient, we're aligned with the rest of the company, and we're doing the things that will actually impact the bottom line. Because the worst case scenario is we do a bunch of stuff, and then people start associating with design with, hey, this doesn't affect the bottom line. And that to me is an ineffective leader. And I only learned that after becoming a founder and then being in this position again.
What are some of the things that you're more able to consider now when taking a step back that maybe you were missing earlier in your career?
I'm able to make trade-offs for the business and design, I think, in a better way than I ever did. So, you know, I kind of negotiated like a CIA negotiator. It was like no compromise in my 20s. And then now I'm just looking at the business. I'm like, okay, yeah, this makes sense. We only have XYZ engineers. We need to meet this deadline for XYZ reasons. We need to validate this business strategy before we sink a whole team of 20 into it. Those are the type of things that I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about resourcing. And I think a lot of designers don't realize, and we're very harsh on founders a lot. When I read Twitter, I feel very bad for founders across the board. I'm sure people are hearing this and rolling their eyes, and it's like, I don't feel bad for founders. And I do, because, you know, as much as you think you know, you don't really know. And founders, you know, go to bed, and the things I worried about are being able to pay people's bills because they had a family, what that looked like, how could I like raise the money so that they could feel stable and safe. Like, those were the things that kept me up at night. It wasn't arguing about whether or not the quality of software is there. It was just like, can I pay this person's bills? Can I tell them that they have a paycheck in 2 weeks? How do I make sure that we're never in a situation where I can't pay the bills? And that's the stuff that I worried about. And so as a designer, I wasn't worried about that. I just, you know, I took for granted that the bills were being paid. I took for granted that I was getting a salary. And while I was doing things that was increasing the revenue for the company, I didn't quite understand how tightly my actions kind of impacted the bottom line and all of these decisions. And so I give a lot of, you know, I can be critical to the past founder of Shopify, or I choose not to. You know, I will never know the amount of information that Toby, who's still the current CEO of Shopify, I will never know the amount of information he has flowing in his head day to day. And I think there's some humility in admitting that and understanding that even now, my current CEO, Avla, he will always have more information than me. And so knowing that I always have incomplete information, how do I make sure that I serve this company well and make the best decisions of my career?
What about from a leadership perspective? You're sitting at the top of this company as the founder, and now you're in this position where you're kind of sitting at the top of the product design org at a really exciting company, AngelList. How is that impacting the way that you are showing up as a leader? And what type of impact do you want to have at AngelList?
Number one, I always want us to ship the best work of our careers. If I could say that I could develop another environment like Shopify again, I'd be so proud of myself. I'm a little bit less worried about things I used to worry about. I worry about the right things now, I think. Or at least the more right things. I don't think you can ever be 100% correct, but at least I think I'm the probability is higher that I'm correct these days. And so I would worry a lot about how people felt. And this doesn't, I don't want to come across as a psychopath here, but quite frankly, we're here to do a job. Design is a job. And I think you're happiest when you win. That's it. I'm just going to underline it, right? When your company is doing well, you're happy. When your employees are proud of themselves, you're happy. They work together when they see themselves winning naturally. So all of these things that come out like as byproducts of corporate life, it's typically when the company's not doing well. They feel the anxiety of the co-founder or the founder or the CEO, and they start to act that way when people get political, when people start grabbing for power, when people start doing all of these things that we all know we don't like. It's typically a sign of instability and employees feeling insecure or not sure about the direction of the company. And so in my 20s, I really thought I could try to like resolve people's problems about how they felt about their jobs or like make them feel happy. And I think perhaps the word I would use is maybe coddle them a little, but that wasn't how I had intended. And that's certainly not how I looked at it then. But I felt like I had leaned in a little bit too hard into the management portion and had not done a better job at the leadership portion, which is just being a really great technical leader, which I had the chops for at the time, but I wasn't doing that well enough in my 20s. And so now that I'm a little bit older, I see now that I wasted some time at Shop just over-optimizing for people's emotions and feelings when I should have been focusing on how they were going to win, how we were going to make the company win, and therefore they were going to feel good for that instead. So a little bit more direct with the actual work and the quality of the work, and a little bit less on like how they were feeling day to day.
I want to go even deeper into that, if that's okay. Because you are talking about the energy that was at Shopify. And I'd like to understand how that trickles into how the team works together and how they ship. And maybe what elements of that culture at Shopify that you would hope to instill at AngelList.
It was chaos. And chaos can be good. Chaos can be fun. Chaos can be shipping the like things every single day and being really proud of it and seeing yourself in the news. And that's what exactly it felt like. You know, when founders always say, you know, when you hit product market fit, and you really, really, really do. Like, it really feels like a rocket is dragging you. And it's, hey, this company is going to be successful and you're going to come with it or not. That's what it felt like. There's a positive energy to that, which is you're proud of going to work every day and you want to put in more work. You want to do the best work of your life. So you naturally do it and it's fun. And I think there's a lot to be said about feeling joy when you work and what the outcomes of joy are versus the outcomes of like feeling terrible every day when you go to work. I think that makes a huge difference. And so if they can come to work every single day at AngelList and feel like, or at least I hope to move into this direction eventually, but if they can feel the same amount of joy and pride about their work, I think that would be truly great.
Your point about like it being fun when you're winning totally resonates. And I think as someone who has basically always worked on smaller teams and startups, you feel that up and down a little bit more, where it's like there are really fun quarters and some that are not so much. And I kind of appreciate that. I find that energizing. Another thing that you said to me that stood out was that your experience has helped you become a better thinker. Can you talk about that a little bit through the lens of design? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think I was quite dogmatic sometimes when I was younger. Again, I was really pushing hard on the craft and trying to represent my craft at this big, big company. And I felt like I needed to do this by maybe sticking to my guns a little bit more than I probably should have. Over, you know, the past decade, I've really honed in on my ability to understand huge amounts of information outside of just like design. Like, forget all of design concerns, but like, what is the actual information coming into this company? Where's the revenue coming from? How do we foresee us trying to achieve this product market fit? Or how do we foresee us ourselves scaling? All of this information comes into, I think, a bigger bucket now in my head. And I can start to identify these patterns a lot better with all of the scattered information. So usually, like, as a designer, you get like user feedback. That's like one type of data. And then there's like another type of data we argue about, which is like A/B testing. That's like kind of like the low type of data, quantitative data. And then there's like bigger, broader questions, like who do we want to be philosophically? Do we want to stand for something in this market? What do we think they actually need? Forget all of the competitors. Where's our revenue coming from? Where does their revenue come from? Like, how does the money flow in this industry? Like, all of this information now feeds into my decisions, and it starts to inform the way I design and the bigger, broader issues we have philosophically when we come up with a new idea. And so a lot of people earlier in their careers may get stuck. Where do I start? Where do I start? Where do I start? That's not a sign of you not knowing where to start. That's a sign of you not having enough information. Because as soon as you start collecting more information, I think it becomes very, very clear what you need to do next. If someone told me like, hey, here's a bunch of financial information in one place, I need you to go protect, you know, the accounting ledger. Like, okay, that's clear. Like, I kind of have a good idea of like what type of product that is, what type of area we're dealing with. And I'm just going to forget coming up with features about social connections, or I'm going to forget about marketing tools, I'm going to forget about advertising tools, and I'm just going to focus purely on finances and what we can do with that data and how to make that data more valuable for the user. That's what I'm thinking about now that I perhaps didn't do enough of before.
You talked about finding product market fit. I'd like to zoom in there and kind of use that as a lens for a little bit. In that early stage where, you know, all of the core questions are still unanswered and you're figuring out everything for the first time, what are you doing to collect the right pieces of information that you need to then think and ultimately design something that ships?
Yeah, so I'm really big into the applied scientific process. So during another thing I didn't tell you, but during the time I took my sabbatical, I went back to school actually, and I did a couple of courses, one in psychology, I did women's studies for a little bit. And then even before that, during my startup, I took some MBA courses. And all of these experiences taught me that the way I was like consolidating information wasn't very structured and streamlined. So I came up with a system, I designed a system that would allow me to collect data points, like disparate data points. So it could be user feedback, but it could be something I read, it could be whatever. And I dump it all into this, you know, system that I've built out in Notion, and I start to identify these trends, and I really have to go through it. It's a very lengthy process, and it's on purpose. It's to get you to kind of like think through all of the information one by one and say, hey, I've seen this before. I've seen this before. I've seen this before. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are like, why don't you just use AI to summarize it? AI just strips out, number one, the work that you need to do. And it also doesn't adequately summarize these little insights that you're missing along the way. And sometimes when people talk about your product, or they talk about the problems, or they talk about whatever, they're not actually saying the thing that you need to build, but they're kind of telling you in other ways. They're kind of telling you how frustrated they are. They're kind of telling you about their day, and you're just kind of like picking that up as you go. And so I dump that all into one place. I usually record it. And I start to write out these notes like, hey, this person is doing this, this person is doing that, my observations, my thoughts, my feelings, anything that comes to mind. And I just kind of brain dump it all into this one system and I tag it all. It's a pretty extensive taxonomy I've developed. And I start to, at that point, I'm starting to identify trends and insights. And that's when I come up with my first hypothesis. Hey, this is the biggest trend I've seen in all of this. And what does that mean for me? So I actually did this at Jupiter. I had some instinct, you know, I had some instinct what they wanted. So what I wanted to do was I built operation software for beauty professionals. So anyone that's working with nails, hair, eyelashes, but also all the way up to medical spas. So facials, lasers, Botox, fillers, all of that stuff. So I wanted to take a look at this group of people, typically female, typically working alongside a job or a bunch of side jobs. So they are their children's caretakers, they are taking care of their grandparents, all these sorts of very, very, very busy women. And I had some sort of instinct on what they kind of wanted. I was like, I think they kind of want this. But that was like a very techie way to do it, like go in and just assume that they needed to do X, Y, Z. And it was only after going through this process, after listening very carefully, and writing down all of this stuff, I realized like, oh yeah, there's something here that's actually not picked up by a lot of these competitors. And to this day, I still think I built like the best calendar system out there for this group of people. And it was because they just weren't very good at taking care of themselves. That was my core insight. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs can kind of understand that, aren't very good at taking care of themselves. And it's because they are working 8 till 12 every single day. And they're dealing with their kids and they're dealing with the grandmother or whatever the case may be. And so we built this calendar that allowed them to set rest times, allowed them to set their working hours, dealt with crazy amounts of flexibility and customization. And to this day, I haven't seen anything like it. It's not even in there in Google Calendar. Like you can set rest times, you can set all of these things. And then we start to get to hammer down even further into that. Hairstylists are known for working 2 to 3 clients at the same time. The more senior they are, the better they are at balancing this, but they hold it all in their head. And so our system actually allowed them to set, hey, this person's going to be processing for about 60 minutes. You have about 60 minutes to go work on a haircut. And we were able to schedule all these clients and ultimately make more revenue for them. But that was an insight I didn't know right away. It took a lot of research. It took a lot of listening to actually get to that moment. And it took a lot of iterations to actually work with them. And unfortunately, by then, just right before I closed the company, someone said to me, I have never been more tightly scheduled and rested before in my life. So I still consider that probably the best design project I ever worked on.
You know, the thing about listening is it's only valuable if you ask good questions. And I think that's a really interesting skill, especially in the early stage where you can't just solve problems. You have to be really good at finding problems. And a lot of that is asking good questions. So can you talk about that piece of your practice a little bit? Like, what are you doing to make sure that you're getting what you need and really uncovering the interesting things that are actionable and not just doing research theater?
Yeah, I guess that is a skill, right? You learn over time. But I always think about, you know, the Y kids. I don't know if y'all were a Y kid. I was a Y kid. But it's this trait that, you know, some really annoying 3-year-olds have. And you say something and their next question, why? 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 Until you kind of like lose it at the end of 10 minutes. But essentially you're that Y kid, but you're an adult, right? And I always just like, you know, it's the basics. Who, what, when, where, and why. And if you don't know, who, what, when, where, and why is a really good place to start. They are annoyed by it. Like, it's not like, you know, I remember there was this one call I was on and the lady had just entered her house and she picked up the phone. She's like, Helen, I'm so sorry. I'm 5 minutes late. And I'm like, it's cool. Why are you late? And then it ended up in this conversation where she's like, I actually have to go pick up my kids. And I just got out of the car because I went grocery shopping and then I have to get on this call with you and then I got to go call the client. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like what, you know, what's the client about? And so it was just very, quite honestly, it starts very innocently, right? Where you're just thinking, why? And it shouldn't hurt you to just ask the question. That's the whole reason they're talking to you, so that you can ask questions. And I often find that designers maybe trip over themselves, like, or apologize for themselves. Oh, I'm sorry for not knowing this. Like, why would you know that? Why would I know what she's thinking about when she's running her business? Like, on what grounds? It's like, I'm not this professional. I haven't been educated in her field. I've never worked a day in her life, and I've never had kids. So, like, why would I just assume I would know that? And she also has the same understanding that I also don't know that. So they're happy to explain to you if you ask at the right time. And I think that was really more a skill I learned over time, which is I often have some sort of script. I've put together 5 or 10 questions. But as she's going, or as the person you're interviewing is talking to you, you should always ask them to expand what they just said. Like, a good interviewer just expands and expands and expands. Like, hey, you said that. Can you explain XYZ so that I absolutely know? Like, you should come away from that conversation having learned something yourself. Did I know that a lot of hairdressers had to, like, kind of schedule out their clients based on processing times? I kind of did, but I didn't know how they made those decisions. So I asked how. Like, I've observed that behavior in a salon. Of course, I've been in a salon, but I never asked them, like, how do you know this person is done and how do you know this person is not done? Well, the answer is pretty simple. I go and check. But had I not asked that, and had I just assumed that the answer was going to be simple, I may not have found that my next insight or something else. And the best case scenario is you find that there's, like, you know, no insight. You're like, okay, it's exactly what I thought. That's great. Then I fully understand where you're coming from. And then the best case scenario is they come up with, like, oh, actually, it's because of this other thing that I didn't know. Like, I didn't know that they measured every single gram that comes out of a coloring bottle, because that's their cost of goods. That's how they make money, their profit margin, right? They measure the bottle before and at the end of the day. I used 10 milliliters out of 60. Or this client, I used 20 out of 60. Next time I should probably charge her more. Like, these are the decisions that they're kind of making on the fly. But they would never tell you until you actually ask why.
How do you take those insights or hypotheses and translate them into goals that you can execute against? And even just to make sure that you're designing on the right track?
Yeah, so that's why I always try to phrase it like a hypothesis or a control. And so if I'm picking up this trend, like, if several of them say, like, I really need you to kind of, like, book them, these people right up against each other, because that's how I make money. I'd say, okay, how many times am I hearing this from this group of people? And how many times do I need to hear this in order to feel any sort of conviction? Well, if I'm a startup, hearing anything really is conviction, right? Because you don't know very much about the industry. Once you're working at scale, like at shop, you need to hear it like 200, 300 times before it becomes a big deal, because you're working with way bigger numbers. So it really depends on the context there. But for a startup, I mean, a hypothesis is small, and it should be small. It should be as fast as possible. Like, for startups, pre-product market fit, you should be testing like 5 hypotheses a day, if you can, as much as possible. Just trying to get out, can I validate this? Like, the statement that they made. They made a statement. Okay, great, turn that into a hypothesis. What does this look like as a product? So if I use my previous example there, where it's like, okay, it looks like they're doing some sort of inventory control by the milliliter, depending on what's in this bottle. What does that tell me? It tells me they need some sort of tracker of these bottles. They need to be able to track what's inside the bottles. That's a hypothesis, right? That's a feature hypothesis. Go and build that feature. Build it out in Figma. Everyone knows what this looks like. Everyone knows that this kind of looks like a product name, some sort of quantity control thing, some sort of delete, remove, whatever. It's a table, right? Show it to them the next hour and be like, is this what you're talking about? Pretty easy. Yes or no, right? Hypothesis proven or not proven. And that is really like the PMF sort of experience that I think changes too when you're earlier on in the business. And to me, that's like the fun part. The fun part is like, you're moving really fast. You're like, what about this? What about this? Does this work? That's the best time in a designer's life. When you're starting to work on things like, oh, I need this to make sure that this moves X KPI up 10% before this is even valid enough to consider executing on. you're dealing with a completely different thing.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. What are some of the other things that you think designers can be proactively doing in these really pre-product market fit early stages to make a strategic impact on the company vision and not be kind of trapped downstream in this execution box?
I think in product market fit, you should be the ideas guy. I don't know how many founders I've spoken to that have told me, Helen, I am the only person coming up with ideas here. I am so stressed out. And that is like the number one thing you should be listening for as a designer. Like if you're lucky enough to be, you know, employee 1 to 5 in a startup, you should be the ideas guy with the founder. You and the founder should be just like eye to eye on absolutely everything, almost in lockstep, because almost everything they care about, you should care about too. You should also care about their pitch decks. You should care about the amount of money that they're bringing in for the company to pay all of your salaries. And that's something that you can help them with. You should also care about talking to the customers and validating what the customers are saying. Like, you are almost like a little mini founder. And the bonus to you is you have the actual skill set to go validate that stuff on their behalf. That makes you indispensable. Every founder I know would adore that type of person. And so prior to product market fit, yeah, you should be the ideas guy. You should be coming up with prototypes on their behalf. You should be going to talk to customers and bringing it up to them. That's how you win, you know, influence. And that's how you actually work with an early stage company and make them feel like you're there with them, as opposed to kind of like downstream and waiting for instruction. No founder wants that.
I love designers as mini founders. I haven't heard that before. I'm going to start using that everywhere. Can you talk a little bit about your process and some of the ways that you've put yourself in a situation where you can generate a lot of ideas? Because there's so many different types of ideas too, right? Like there's a wide spectrum that you're exploring for any given problem, but then you're also on this time horizon too, where you're like things that are more realistic for a small company versus, you know, really painting the future. So how do you think about the types of ideas that you're generating and then presenting to founders, especially when it's unprompted?
I think it really depends on what they don't know. So I think depending on the founder, some founders will have very deep insider knowledge. So depending on, you know, if they've been in the industry before. And so what they're actually looking for is like low level validation because they have a grander picture of the business. If someone was a founder of, let's say, Zillow, and they had been working in real estate for about 20 years with their dad, let's say, they're going to have stuff in their brain that you don't know. Like, they're just going to have way more stuff, way more understanding of how the industry currently moves. You don't need to validate stuff. You don't need to go out there and be like, do realtors need listings? That's not stuff you need to validate. But what they do need to validate is like what they don't see. So what's inherent in someone who has worked in real estate for 20 years? What are their blind spots? Their blind spots are probably they're not involved in the day-to-day of XYZ function. So they probably don't know the ins and outs of a property manager, right? You can go flesh that out for them. Or they probably don't know the little minor details of like, you know, what building contractors are doing when they're kind of like putting in details for permits and all of that stuff. Does that matter for real estate? We don't know, right? But if that's your vertical, go and figure that out. Go bring that information back. Do you think this is useful? Do you think it's important? Do you think there's a valuable market here? Or alternatively, there are other founders that are like, I'm really good at making software and I'm going to make software for X industry, but I have no understanding of what that industry is like. Okay. All right, so we are trying to understand the broad strokes there. And to me, that's like, okay, I'm going to start working on like understanding the competitors in the market. I'm going to start understanding the entire product suite relevant to this vertical. So if this person said to me, hey, I'm going to create like the next grocery delivery. I'm really good at software. I'm an engineer. And I'd be like, okay, all right. So we need to kind of understand the players here. Like, who are the biggest players in this market? Instacart, DoorDash, who are people that are kind of related, but not really direct competitors? Maybe Uber. They have a business unit that's dedicated to this. They could potentially go into this business unit. And I'd start to like actually map this out with the founder. Does this match what you're thinking? And if it doesn't, then what do we need to work on to add some clarity? The whole point of a designer is to add clarity, right? To validate or add clarity. So in this case, I'm playing the role of like trying to help them understand their own industry and being like, is this where you actually want to go? Does this make sense to you? Does this make you feel confident? Do we need to do more research? Are you excited about this area of the market? Like, those are the types of questions that you can help answer with them.
It reminds me actually of a conversation I was having with someone yesterday, a past guest on this show actually, and he talked about how as an interviewer, it's your job to help someone navigate their own forest of knowledge. They have this big body of learnings and knowledge and insights, but sometimes somebody simply asking the right questions can help them arrive at insights. And so that's kind of an interesting thing that you just made me think of, where as an early designer, a role that you can play is even just asking the questions to a founder and helping them shape and morph their own body of knowledge in a given industry.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I think I just read like this LinkedIn post the other day, and this person was frustrated that they were being challenged all the time. And I was like, that's actually a really good sign. It's a good sign. It means that they're actually listening to you, first of all. Anyone who can challenge you means that they listen to you to begin.
I want to pivot a little bit before I have to let you go and create some space for you to reflect on your own journey and your own learnings, because you said something kind of interesting to me, which is you talked about this idea of making sacrifices in production skills over your career. And maybe that's like prototyping in code or learning, you know, the latest motion design tool. My question is, what were you focusing on instead? And specifically, how do you think that that has shaped your value proposition as a designer?
Yeah, so I think you have to make decisions in your career about how you have to spend your time. Earlier in my career, I was always like the technical designer. I wanted to be the best of my craft. So I wanted to learn how to code, which I did, and I could have gone further into that, but I didn't. Or I wanted to get really good at motion, but I kind of stopped there too. And it was because I kept running into these skill sets that I wanted to pick up. And so one of them was when I was running Jupiter, I could have been full-on designer founder. I could have created all of the prototypes and gone out to validate it. But instead, I took MBA courses. I took some classes and I learned how to speak, quote unquote, business and become a businesswoman. And it was for a good reason. It was because I wanted to actually make sure our business was successful and that I could have an investor meeting and people wouldn't just laugh me out of the room. And I had to let go of the time sink, like the time trade-off for that, right? I could have spent some more time getting into the code and doing that. And certainly I've seen designer founders do that. And I really admire them for that. But I just didn't think that that was a good use of time for me at whatever juncture it came to me around the time of Jupiter. And so, yeah, that was my trade-off. I made the sacrifice to not become a better designer crafter in exchange for becoming a better business person. And I think I've made this same trade-off several times throughout my career. And this has made me pretty indispensable for designer founders, because I think I can learn to think on my feet. I understand where they're coming from a lot of the time. I can prioritize what they're worried about against the design outcomes and make sure they still end up validating their idea and making sure they still come up with like a good, pretty good outcome in the end. So all of that was worthwhile, but it put me in a very specific niche. I am best, like I'm very, very fast, but I am best in a small team. I am best validating an idea. I'm best adding clarity to something that's unclear. When it comes to scaling a very, very large company, not the greatest hire for them. And I'm not the happiest then either.
I think something that I appreciate is that your background is a little bit atypical. Like, you've done so many different things. You've done the educator route and founder and IC and now design leader again. And I guess I am wondering if you have more to share on just how you think about growing as not only a designer, but like a coworker and a human, because I know there's somebody listening that feels maybe even self-conscious about being in a similar situation where their LinkedIn maybe just doesn't even really make sense. So can you talk about your vantage point now on the other side of that journey and maybe any advice that you have for that person who's listening?
I think it's Steve Jobs, but he has a very, very famous quote, like, you can only connect the dots looking backwards. And my career only looks like a career because I connected the dots for people backwards. But on the way there, it was very confusing for me too. And I was just trying to chase what I could learn the whole way and keep myself engaged and happy day to day. And I just forgot the whole, you know, what will people think of me, all of that stuff. I only had two goals, you know, definitely we all have bills to pay, so you should definitely pay your bills. And then the second concern is like, how will I be happy day to day? And I was optimizing for that. And for me, learning has always been happy and joyful and a place of comfort. And so I've deeply optimized for that and worried about my career later. And so if you look at my career, there's a common design thread through it all. But I definitely was optimizing for something different. And that's okay. You know, learning should be fun. Like, we always talk about imposter syndrome, and we always talk about, you know, how stressed out we are that technology is coming out every single day. And it's like, yeah, okay. And instead of being overwhelmed and focusing on how terrible that all feels, maybe focus on the joy and optimize for joy and optimize for the things that, you know, make you happy day to day.
One of the things that you're doing right now is hiring an AngelList, which is a very exciting company. And I'd like to hear from you a little bit about some of the underlying traits that you're looking for in candidates and maybe what people can do to communicate that to you, either in their portfolio or maybe the hiring process.
Yeah, I think what makes AngelList really unique and some of the primary reasons why I joined is it's a mostly senior team. So I had shared with you that the R&D team is actually quite small. It is around 50 or 55 people, if I'm not mistaken. And so you're in an environment where there's a lot of people who are experienced and just want to get shit done, which is quite a relief after working in tech for so long. And it feels very, very, very good to be around those types of people. So we're also looking for people who thrive in that environment, who thrive with, hey, I don't really know what's going on or what to ship next. And they're like, perfect, that's great. And I'm that type of person too, right? So we do tend to prefer more independent people. We tend to prefer people who are excited by like unlimited agency and autonomy and people who really love their craft and want to kind of get stuff out the door. Another thing that's really interesting about AngelList is a very intellectual culture. And so we strive to be more critical thinkers across the board and just make sure that we're held accountable for all of the work that we do. And whether it's like, you know, obviously when it's great quality, everybody wants to be accountable for that, right? But if it's bad quality, it's like you have to be okay with being like, hey, I did that, my bad, I'm gonna fix it. And so we're looking for people who have shown, number one, signs of independence and signs of wanting more surface area and wanting to grab a hold of like a big meaty problem and just digging right deep into it. And then second of all, we want people with depth, like intellectual curiosity and depth. When you're presented with a problem, you don't stop at like just the most shallow application or solution for that problem, but you're just diving in deep, really, really trying to understand the problem as much as you can. And really just going after it. So that's the type of people that we're looking for. And in terms of portfolios, like, again, I should see signs of someone who has some intellectual curiosity. Don't really love like the cookie cutter projects that are like, I made a dog walking app. And it's like, no one really needs that. I think if you're doing a portfolio project for yourself, I think you should maybe go explore like a really complicated problem like waste management solutions and try to go deep into that. And really just like prove to me that you've fallen in love with the problem, because some people don't. So that's what AngelList is really looking for. We're dealing with very, very complex work. A lot of it is financial, and a lot of it is like rules and regulations and compliance. So I really need like detail-oriented people who are really, really interested in kind of like taking on big, meaty financial problems.
Well, Helen, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time to share from your journey and just how you're thinking about these different types of problems and your process. It's been super insightful and much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.